You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Solomon's Dilemma by William D. Cohen. The Domain never made it to his wine cellar. One day, a friend alerted Solomon that it looked like the pricey bottles he had purchased were showing up for sale online. Solomon confronted his family's personal assistant, Nicholas de Meyer, who was supposed to take delivery of wine shipments. De Meyer, it turned out, was really Nicholas Meyer, a Vassar graduate from Findlay, Ohio. For 2 years, according to a court indictment, Meyer had stolen hundreds of bottles of wine from Solomon, worth more than $1.2 million. Using the alias Mark Miller, the name of a well-known Hudson Valley vintner who died in 2008, Meyer allegedly had the bottles delivered to himself instead of to the Solomons, and then fenced them on the Internet. After agreeing to pay the Solomons back, Meyer fled the country. Last January, as he was returning to the United States, he was arrested at the Los Angeles airport. Released on a $1 million bond, secured by $200,000 in cash and his mother's home, Meyer has been trying to negotiate a settlement with prosecutors in New York. Solomon, meanwhile, is doing just fine. His insurance covered the loss, and he still owns a home in the Bahamas, a New York apartment in Soho that he is renovating, and a tract of land in the Hudson Valley. Last year, he sold his jaw-dropping 83-acre estate in Aspen for $36 million. Inevitably, though, Solomon's greatest passion is for Goldman Sachs. Having worked for three investment banks that no longer exist, he knows how precarious a place Wall Street can be. He also knows how exceptional Goldman is compared to its competitors. "I was a big producer at Bear Stearns," he says. "I built a lot of relationships there and brought a lot of relationships to the firm. But nobody ever woke up and said, 'Hey, I need an investment banker. I think I'll call Bear Stearns.'" One of the great things here is that people do wake up and say, "Hey, why don't I call Goldman Sachs?" That gives us a responsibility to always put extraordinary people in front of them. What comes through most clearly as Solomon assumes command of Goldman is his overriding sense of stewardship. The company will celebrate its 150th anniversary next year, a legacy its new CEO is determined to extend. Even if the firm must remake itself to survive, as it has done so many times in the past. You look at the history of any company, Goldman Sachs included, and it's not a straight line, Solomon says. Wall Street happens to be a place with a long history of volatility. Like any organization, we have to continue to evolve if we want to be around for another 150 years. We've got to have a good strategy and good people and a good culture and probably a little bit of luck. Queen Elizabeth. As her new film, Widows, hits theaters, Elizabeth Debicki wears this season's couture. Photographs by Daniel Jackson, styled by Samir Nasser. And in these photos, she wears various articles of clothing by Chanel, Schiaparelli, and Valentino, as well as by Maison Margiela and Bumble and Bumble. The discovery of Australian actress Elizabeth Debicki was one of those mythical big breaks of Hollywood, writes Britt Hennemuth for this article. In 2011, after Baz Luhrmann had cast his kaleidoscopic $105 million interpretation of The Great Gatsby with bankables Leonardo DiCaprio, Carey Mulligan, he went looking for an unknown to play Jordan Baker and spotted promise in his countrywoman. At the time, she recalls, I had no money. I couldn't pay my rent. But she got the call back and hopped a flight to L.A. The rest was, as they say, boats beating on. Since then, Debicki has been seducing Le Carré heroes in miniseries, The Night Manager, Traveling the Cosmos with Marvel, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, and playing villain for Guy Ritchie, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Next month, she stars in Steve McQueen's Widows, a crowd-pleasing heist film with dark twist of inequality and corruption, penned by McQueen and Gillian Flynn. Debicki plays Alice, a doll-like Polish-American woman stunted by her abusive marriage. The role was not easy. Alice has only ever known danger. It's so subtle. The casualness of the violence is so affecting, says Debicki. Her character embraces a new kind of danger as one of four unlikely women, played by Viola Davis, Michelle Rodriguez, and Cynthia Erivo, all of whom smashed it, says Debicki, who must finish the job after their husband's robbery goes awry. I remember being so anxious. At one point, I went up to Steve and grabbed him, put your hands on my heart, and he goes, that's nothing. Debicki says the director is only after truth. Once he has the performance, you know it's safe. McQueen admires her in return. She threw everything right on the floor and amazed me, he says. I think she found herself. It's strange to say that, but she was so enjoying this really hard task. Debicki credits her fearlessness to a grade-A mentor and one-time onstage co-star, Kate Blanchett. She taught me a performance has to be messy and scrappy before it can take flight, says Debicki. There is no better acting class. The Sultan of Bling. He lived the life of a Saudi prince, and investors all over the world fell for it. But the truth turned out to be even more incredible than the lie. by Mark Seal. Illustrations by R. Kikuo Johnson. Opening illustration, Miami Vice. Prince Khalid knew how to use displays of wealth to land a deal. And in this illustration, we see the palm trees of Miami in the background, Art Deco buildings, water, and Prince Khalid stands beside his fancy sports car, bodyguards around him wearing lots of blingy jewelry, fancy luggage beside him as he's escorted to his waiting yacht. "My name is Khalid," he tells me, and I want to believe him. After all, he has traveled the world as royalty, the son of the king of Saudi Arabia, no less. Leading international investors know him as His Royal Highness Khalid bin Al Saud. He moved in an entourage of Rolls Royces and Ferraris, his every whim tended to by uniformed housekeepers and armed bodyguards. A suave British-born CEO handled his business affairs, and a well-connected international banker marketed his investment deals to a select few, leaving him to live a life of astonishing excess. Ever since he was a boy, he had been pitted against his royal brothers in an expensive game, to see who could outdo the other one in spending, he liked to say. Khalid was surely winning. He was in negotiations to purchase 30% of the famed Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach for $440 million, and he was selling early access to what promised to be the biggest IPO in history, the initial public offering of Aramco, the Saudi oil giant. Until last June, when the Saudi government shelved the plan, the IPO was expected to be worth more than $2 trillion. Khalid could regularly be overheard talking on his phone with the likes of Bill Gates and Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. "I'm sick and tired of Trump calling me and inviting me to the White House," he often complained. He kept in touch with his father, the Saudi king, on FaceTime, and if you were lucky, he would let you listen in. But the prince's favorite companion was Foxy, his beloved Chihuahua, whom he draped in diamonds and designer dog clothes and toted around in a $2,690 Louis Vuitton dog carrier. He stuffed other Louis Vuitton bags with stacks of $100 bills, tossing the money from his jewel-encrusted fingers, one sporting a 9-carat diamond, to those who tended to his needs, flashes of benevolence from an academic genius whose LinkedIn page lists his law studies at Harvard, his master's in business administration from the University of Southern California, and his top marks at Institut Lorosi, the elite Swiss boarding school attended by Rockefellers and Rothschilds. He lived in a penthouse on Fisher Island, a super-wealthy enclave that sprawls across 216 acres south of Miami. But he spent much of his life on his yacht and private jet, which he chronicled religiously on his Instagram account, Prince Dubai 07. There were pictures of Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, the fabulously wealthy grandson of the first Saudi king, whose major stakes in U.S. companies alone include Citigroup and Twitter. "Uncle," Khalid posted beside one photo. "My new yacht," he said in Instagram videos from his travels. "My plane and my Ferrari." There were endless posts of pieces of jewelry from his vast collection. "Birthday gifts from the fam," he wrote, alongside twin diamond watches draped over $10,000 bundles of cash. His star-struck followers couldn't get enough. "Oh, Lord," groaned one. I had spent weeks tracing Khalid's incredible trail before his email arrived. "As you might know, my story is not what it looks like," he wrote. "There is so much to tell, and so much that needs to come to the light. He would tell his story exclusively to me, he promised, if I left out certain parts. Like so many of his offers, it was one that promised a wealth of opportunity in return for very little. In the end, though, I decided to decline, because Khalid wasn't writing me from his yacht, or his penthouse on Fisher Island, or his father's palace in Dubai, but from a cell at the Federal Detention Center in Miami, where he awaits trial on charges of fraud, traveling on a fake passport, impersonating a foreign official, and identity theft. His true identity, which was revealed after his arrest at JFK Airport last November, isn't Prince Khalid of Saudi Arabia, but Anthony Enrique Guignac, a Colombian orphan, adopted by an American couple and transported to Michigan when he was 6 years old. Embarking on a life of crime and deception that spanned 30 years, he became an epic con artist for whom no scheme is out of reach, according to a U.S. attorney. His most recent scam involved allegedly duping 26 international investors out of $8 million, while simultaneously attempting to con Miami billionaire Jeffrey Soffer, the ex-husband of supermodel Elle McPherson, into taking him on as a partner in the Fontainebleau Hotel. Guignac initially pleaded guilty to both schemes, only to reverse himself at a hearing in July, where his attorney successfully argued for a trial by jury. "Mr. Guignac is very upset about the way this investigation was handled," his attorney told the judge. Suddenly, without permission to address the court, Guignac leapt up in his drab prison garb and unleashed a string of accusations about perceived injustices against him. "I have also been a victim," he later wrote me, "but watching him in court that day, I recalled what someone who knew him in Miami had said. 'You mean the fake Prince of Fisher Island?' the man told me. To play the role he played so well for so long, he had to believe the lie. He actually believes he is Khalid, the Prince of Saudi Arabia. I was sucked into absolute mayhem. He dangled such a carrot. Even though you knew he was full of shit, the carrot was so big, and there was a 2.2% chance that there was some truth in his asinine lies, that you kept going. He was so talented and pulled off so much shit, I don't even know where to begin." It began in Bogota, where the future prince was born, José Enrique Moreno, in 1970. Parents unknown, he was one of Colombia's 13,000 throwaway children, many of whom become foot soldiers in the country's brutal drug war. "They have no name and no nationality," wrote one of Guignac's attorneys, Karen J. Davis Roberts, in a 2007 sentencing memorandum. "Some kids worked as drug runners, sniffing glue to numb themselves to the cold and hunger. Many who tried to sell drugs on their own wound up murdered by the cartels. Those who survived were treated like rodents," wrote the attorney. "When most children at the tender age of 5 were going to kindergarten, snuggling in their warm beds at night after being fed a full meal, Tony was in the streets of Bogota, foraging for food, stealing if necessary, and just looking for a dry, safe, warm place to rest his 5-year-old head and somewhere to take care of his 3-year-old brother. What Tony learned in his first few years of life was survival at any cost, survival of the fittest." Guignac added his own vivid details to the story. "I was raped when I was 5 years old and sold on the streets to have sex with men to feed my brother," he once testified under oath. "You do not know the pain that I've gone through. After 2 years on the streets, deliverance arrived on June 13, 1977, in the form of Jim Gignac and Nancy Fitzgerald. A middle-class couple from Plymouth, Michigan, they came to Bogota to pick up Jose and his brother through an adoption arranged by a local orphanage. Whisk away to their new home in Michigan, the boys would stuff their cheeks with food at dinner, looking like two little chipmunks, because they weren't sure they would get another meal, the attorney wrote. Renamed Anthony, Tony was a fast study. By second grade, he could speak English as well as his American-born classmates. But his early years in Bogota had left their mark. As a street kid, he struggled to survive, while the rich lived in huge houses with walls and security guards. He yearned for the good life and the limelight, says someone who knew him when he first arrived in America. He wanted to be someone important. From early on, Tony's desire for status had a way of blossoming into lies. His mother was so rich, he told his first-grade classmates, that she owned the historic Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. His biological father, he said in second grade, was the actor Dom DeLuise. Tony was involved in convincing anyone in school that he had money, that he had power, the attorney wrote, because if he had the combination of power and money, then he would never be alone. One day, when Tony was in sixth grade, his mother received a call. "Your Mercedes is ready," the caller told her. Tony, it turned out, had duped a car dealership into believing that he was a Saudi prince whose dad was going to buy him a Mercedes. An eager salesman picked him up at a shopping mall and gave him some test rides. When neither payment nor prince arrived to pick up the car, a sheriff's deputy was dispatched to the Gignac home to find out what was going on. Tony's parents tried to get him help. He started therapy at 12, says Lisa Whitehead, a clinical therapist who knew Tony when he was young. They sent him to a camp, and he would tell everybody that he had great wealth and importance. Things got worse when Tony's parents divorced, and his brother went to live with their father. "The one person who meant anything to me, my brother, who I took under my wings, was taken from me," Gignac later testified. He suffered a mental breakdown and spent time in two psychiatric hospitals and a halfway house as a ward of the state. "But he ran away at age 17, his attorney wrote. "He was alone on the streets and felt that his mother had abandoned him." Determined to avoid repeating the life of a street kid, Tony set out to remake his entire identity. Convincing an Arab family in Ypsilanti, Michigan, that he was a prince, he warned them that his father's secret police would pay them a visit if they didn't take him in. Around the same time he was living with them, he had one of his first run-ins with the law. At age 17, he was caught masquerading as Prince Adnan Khashoggi, the notorious Saudi arms dealer who was then the world's richest man. 2 months later, Gignac turned up in Los Angeles, where he was convicted of using a credit card with the name Omar Khashoggi to bilk a limousine company out of $8,650. He was attracted to Hollywood because of all the glamour and wealth, recalls Lisa Whitehead, who became his mother's partner after the divorce. That's where he said he met a prince, a real prince. Whether or not the prince was real, the story provided Gignac with the perfect pose for what would become a series of elaborate cons. "I had a sexual relationship with certain members of the Saudi royal family since I was 17, he testified at a 2007 sentencing hearing. "This is one of the most powerful families in the world. They are secretive, There is no information about these people on the internet. Because homosexuality is a crime in Saudi Arabia, Guignette seemed to suggest, the prince was forced to support him for the rest of his life, or face the consequences. You were killed, executed, pushed off a high mountain, he told the court, which is what they do to homosexuals. The Saudis have denied any connection to Guignette. He was not a member of the royal family, nor associated in any way with the Saudi royal family, an assistant to the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia told federal officials in 2003. But to Guignette's family, it all seemed real. When he got arrested, he would have the prince's credit card, says Whitehead. Somebody always paid the bills. Maybe they wanted to keep him quiet. We actually worried for his safety. The person who seemed to fall for the story most deeply was Guignette himself. As a street kid from Colombia, growing up in a lily-white town in Michigan, it had been tough to fit in. His voice was feminine. He wore his hair in a bowl cut, and he struggled with his weight. He was just a short, fat, talking machine, says one of his former attorneys. Now, with a kiss from a supposed prince, the boy who felt like a frog was instantly transformed into a prince himself. Guignette, claiming to have legally changed his name to that of a real Saudi prince, Khalid bin al-Saud, started off with small-time grifting. Prince of Fraud, the Los Angeles Times dubbed him in 1991, when he stiffed the Regent Beverly Wilshire Hotel for $3,488 in room and food charges during a four-day binge in July. He racked up $7,500 in limousine bills, burning up the freeways from Torrance to Malibu on excursions that lasted until dawn. He talked Rodeo Drive shopkeepers out of a set of Louis Vuitton luggage and a rare coin collection, only to leave the hotel in handcuffs, despite repeated promises that his father, the prince, would make good on his debts. Employees of the famed Wilshire Boulevard Hotel addressed him as Your Highness. He was 21. Next illustration, Prince of Lies. Posing as Saudi royalty, Guignette would go on shopping sprees for Rolexes and diamond bracelets. A year later, after serving a brief stint in jail, the freshly crowned prince moved into the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco. Using an American Express card under the name of Khalid bin al-Saud, he built the hotel out of an extended stay. After serving 53 days in jail, he fled the city, failing to report to his probation officer. Flying to the idyllic Halekulani Hotel in Honolulu for the Christmas holidays, he conned an unsuspecting couple into writing him a check for $8,500 for a share in an oil field in Saudi Arabia, which didn't exist, according to court documents. Convincing another couple, Gilbert and Irene Getz, that he had reasons to fear for his life, he duped them into paying his $20,912.20 resort tab, a scam that 25 years later still seems to sting. "I don't want to talk to you," Gilbert Getz tells me when I call, before slamming down the phone. In July 1993, Prince Khalid checked into the Walt Disney World Grand Floridian Beach Resort in Orlando, where he ran up more than $14,000 in fraudulent credit card charges. He pleaded guilty, was given probation, and once again vanished. A month later, he turned up at the Grand Bay Hotel in Coconut Grove, where on December 30th, after a credit card shopping spree, he invited two men up to his suite to party. These were no princes. They beat and robbed him, according to the Miami Herald, and the police were called. Again, looking at disappeared, this time to Chicago, where he was finally arrested and extradited to Florida for swindling the Grand Bay out of $27,000 and the local Saks Fifth Avenue out of $51,175. Charged with fraud and grand theft, he was sentenced to 616 days. Being locked up, however, did nothing to deter Gignac's creative impulses. Before his trial even started, while he was sitting in jail, he began contacting lawyers as Khalid bin al-Saud. One of those who rose to the bait was Oscar Rodriguez, a Miami attorney. He said he was a member of the Saudi family, and they were going to get him bail, and his father was going to pay for my services, Rodriguez recalls. Sensing a business opportunity, the attorney enlisted two bail bondsmen, Tom O'Connell and Francisco Marti, to post a $46,000 bond to spring the prince from jail. Oscar was just mesmerized, recalls O'Connell. He thought he was going to be the attorney for the whole kingdom. Bullshit, says Rodriguez. But he did say when the Saudis got in trouble, I could be the lawyers to take care of them. Two of O'Connell's bondsmen picked up the prince from jail and drove him back to their office, where they waited for the money from his family. But the hours passed, and the funds never arrived. Listen, Prince, the money's not coming, Rodriguez told him. We gotta put you back in jail. But on the way back to the detention center, the prince came up with another idea. There's an American Express office, he told the bondsman. Can you stop there? He entered the office in tears, claiming he'd been mugged, his credit card stolen. He said his father, the king, would be most upset, the Miami Herald later reported. American Express agreed to issue a replacement card if he could correctly answer a security question. What were your last two purchases? Gignac miraculously was able to verify the last two purchases on the card belonging to the real Prince Khalid, one in California, one in France. Fearful of offending Gignac if he truly was actually a prince, American Express issued him a platinum card the next day, the Herald reported. The card had a $200 million line of credit. Gignac immediately booked two limos and embarked on a shopping spree, his bondsman in tow. Heading to a jeweler on Miracle Mile in Coral Gables, he bought two Rolex watches, along with a bracelet covered in emeralds and diamonds. The bill came to $22,120. Next, accompanied by O'Connell's bondsman, Gignac flew home to Michigan. He bought out the entire first-class cabin of a Delta flight, O'Connell recalls, because a prince can't sit on a plane with anyone else. Gignac visited a university, where he promised to donate $1 million in exchange for a scholarship for a friend. Afterwards, he turned around and headed back to Miami. He flew up and back in one day, O'Connell says. We thought, he is the prince. Then a call came from the American Express fraud department. They told us, he's not the prince. He's committing credit card fraud right now, says O'Connell. We called Oscar and said, he's not the prince, and he's gone a boogie. Rodriguez was stunned. He's on a plane to New York with my wife and my daughter, he replied. Rodriguez's wife was taking their daughter to school in New York City. The prince had upgraded them to first class and booked an entire floor of the Four Seasons Hotel. Rodriguez immediately phoned his wife and said, make sure he stays in the room. The lawyer, accompanied by O'Connell and Marty, jumped on the next flight to New York. There, they headed to the Four Seasons, where they entered Gignac's suite and ordered him to surrender. I'm calling the embassy, the prince protested. I'm not going back to Miami. You're right. You're not going to Miami, O'Connell replied. You're going out the effing window. Picking up Gignac, he threw him across the room. The prince hit the wall and landed in a heap. He came down and said, I'll go to Miami, O'Connell recalls. But the prince didn't give up. At LaGuardia, while O'Connell was booking three seats to Miami, Gignac spotted three airport police officers. I'm Prince Khalid bin al-Saud, he shouted. I've been kidnapped. Pointing at O'Connell, he screamed, he has a gun. The cops came out of the woodwork. And I have a shotgun against my head because they think I've kidnapped a prince, O'Connell recalls. The prince was still yelling. If there are any of my loyal subjects here, please call the embassy and CNN. After O'Connell showed the police his paperwork, the cops dispersed. Rather than risk another incident, the bondsman rented a car for the 24-hour drive to Miami. As an added precaution, they threw Gignac in the trunk of the car. We rested along the way and took him out of the trunk, O'Connell says. That is when he told us he wasn't a prince. He gave us his real name, where he was born, everything. Gignac even revealed how he had managed to answer the security question at American Express. He told us that the two Rolexes he bought after we bailed him out went to his two inside people at American Express, who gave him the answers to the questions, O'Connell says. We drove him back to jail in Miami and got our bond back. Next illustration, Smokey and the Bandit. Jailed for wire fraud, Gignac set his cell on fire, hoping to make his escape. Back in jail, Gignac kept right on going. One day in the summer of 1994, officials at Syracuse University were contacted by Prince Khalid bin al-Saud of Saudi Arabia. His Royal Highness stated his intention to donate $45 million to the university. His only stipulation was that the university kindly wire a portion of the taxes for the donation. $16,000 to his account in East Lansing, Michigan. Syracuse did, in fact, wire this money, wrote an assistant U.S. attorney. The bank account, it turned out, had been opened by Gignac's younger brother, with whom he had recently been reunited. Both men were convicted, and the prince was sentenced to 46 months for wire fraud. An additional 37 months were added to his sentence when he lit his cell on fire and covered the floor with shampoo, hoping to trip up the guards and make his escape. In 1996, again, from his jail cell, Gignac enlisted another attorney in Miami, this time to help him get what he claimed he was owed by his uncle, the powerful Prince Al-Walid bin Talal. When I call the lawyer, who asks not to be identified, he emits a groaning response that I would become accustomed to hearing upon mention of Gignac's name. Oh, God, he moans. I seem to be afflicted by him. He is a serious embarrassment to me. He could convince you that he was a green toad instead of a human being. To verify his identity, Gignac told the attorney to call Santa Monica College. According to what appears to be a college transcript, Khalid bin al-Saud attended the college in 1992, earning a 4.0 GPA in human biology and macroeconomics. The college, citing privacy rules, declines to discuss student records. A campus policeman told me people would bring him to school in a limousine and pick him up, recalls the lawyer. One day, the prince asked the lawyer to drive to the Miami airport and pick up a famous attorney who was arriving that afternoon to discuss his case. None other than Johnny Cochran, by then renowned for his defense of O.J. Simpson. Cochran and his partner, Carl Douglas, headed straight to the jail to meet with the prince. They debriefed Khalid for 2 hours, says the lawyer. Everything was consistent. He didn't miss a beat. Cochran was impressed, but did not take the Prince's case. There were real questions about authenticity, Douglas recalls. But the Miami attorney, who received his law degree from Yale, was undeterred. I show him a notarized letter he wrote to Prince Al-Walid, dated February 4, 1997. Signed by his imprisoned client, it demanded that Al-Walid execute all titles to 8 properties that Prince Khalid claimed had been promised to him, including an apartment in Trump Tower and $34 million in Palm Beach real estate. The attorney stares at the letter. I feel like a damn fool for ever listening to this guy, he says. I had Khalid derangement syndrome. I cross-examine liars for a living, and I could not trip him up. It was outrageous on its face. But so is everything about the Saudi family. He wasn't dealing with fringe people. He was dealing with Al-Walid. Did you ever hear back from Al-Walid, I ask? Of course not, he says. Released in the early 2000s, Kignac returned to his mother's home in Michigan. We took him to dinner at the only restaurant we had here in Eaton Rapids, full of rednecks and their families, and he comes in wearing a white fur coat and driving a white Cadillac, recalls Lisa Whitehead. Kignac's mother died in 2008. He had acrylic nails and all this gold around his neck, and silk shirts, very flamboyant and feminine, an everybody-look-at-me type guy. One night, the family went to see Catch Me If You Can, the 2002 film starring Leonardo DiCaprio as master con artist Frank Abagnale. The prince was not impressed. He said, "I'm so much better than that guy," recalls Whitehead. Kinnick hired Whitehead's 17-year-old daughter, Jessica, as his personal assistant. Everywhere they went, people went out of their way to help the prince. A car rental agency gave him 2 Cadillacs without asking for a credit card. He dined without checks, shopped without bills, all thanks to what Kignac called his royal boo, implying that a Saudi prince was picking up the tab. He said he was a kept man, Jessica says, and was well taken care of. At one point, after Kignac skipped out on a local hotel, he asked Jessica to go to his room to pick up his belongings. She found cash hidden under the mattress, jewelry wrapped in towels, and several Western Union transfers for around $10,000 each. They came, she says, from Saudi Arabia. After a stop in Atlanta, where he scammed a local doctor out of $5,000 while saying he was in town to buy the Atlanta Falcons, Kignac's run seemed to come to an end. Back in Troy, Michigan, on January 3, 2003, he was arrested in his white Cadillac outside a shopping mall for impersonating a diplomat. He had charged $11,300 at Saks Fifth Avenue to what he claimed was his family account, which actually belonged to the real Saudi Princess Fadwa Al Saud. He also charged $17,691 to the account of the real Prince Khalid at Neiman Marcus, where he threatened employees for not showing proper respect to a royal. "You cannot do this," Kignac said as police handcuffed him in the parking lot. "You must call the embassy." The State Department dispatched Ed Seitz, a celebrated agent with the Diplomatic Security Services, to interview the prince in jail. In his statement, Kignac said that he had been the lover of a Saudi prince and another member of the Saudi family and had received hush money not to disclose the affairs. He insisted that he had been officially adopted by Prince Al-Walid, issued a Saudi diplomatic passport by the Saudi embassy, and given a $480 million trust fund to live off while he negotiated a lump sum settlement with the royal family. He also claimed that the Saudis had used him as a mule to traffic money to terrorists. A federal agent searched State Department databases and found no record of the subject. And while there is a true Khalid al-Saud, the agent added, he has no connection to Gignac, who assumed the name to defraud the royal family of Saudi Arabia. The real Prince Khalid faxed a notarized letter to Neiman Marcus, stating upon oath that he did not know Gignac and had not authorized him to charge to his account. Next illustration, you can't do this. Arrested for impersonating a diplomat, Gignac continued to run his cons from prison. While he was in jail awaiting trial, Gignac tried again. Mailing a letter to Citibank, he demanded that $3.9 million from a real prince's trust fund be wired to him. On October 12, 2006, he pleaded guilty to attempted bank fraud and impersonating a foreign diplomat. He was sentenced to 77 months in federal prison. By the time he was released in December 2011, Gignac was ready to up his game. Violating the terms of his probation, he headed to Florida, long a paradise for outlaws and deadbeats. With his ambition growing, he wasn't content with merely bilking luxury hotels. He attempted to buy them. Clad in Louis Vuitton, draped in diamonds, and boasting of a Beverly Hills address, he went to the legendary Chica Lodge and Spa in the Florida Keys and offered $200 million for the 27-acre resort. But the hotel's director of security didn't buy his act, and Gignac soon found himself back in a Michigan court. This time, though, prosecutors had new evidence against him. The FBI had seized a big black binder containing all of Gignac's documents, hundreds of notarized letters and faxes and legal correspondence and requests for wire transfers that served as proof of his long, if one-sided, interactions with the Saudi royals. The binder was his secret weapon, a cache of official-looking paperwork, punctuated with impressive seals and stamps, that he could draw on over and over to create the appearance of legitimacy. When someone who is not familiar with this defendant looks at the documents, a prosecutor said in a 2012 court hearing, it appears as if things are, you know, sort of in order. It is sort of a con that he plays on the courts, on the system, on agents, on everyone. The documents, many flagged attorney-client privilege, were merely the work of a defendant who is a confidence man and has been throughout his entire life. In the end, Gignac was sentenced to another year in prison. After the hearing, he asked the court to return his black binder to him. Gignac had not only mastered the art of the con, he had given it his own unique spin. In a stroke of genius, he combined the classic tricks of old-school grifters, stealing a famous name, striking an elaborate pose, with the look-at-me obsessions of the social media age. Look at my Instagram to see whom I have been involved with, he wrote me from jail, as if to say, how could it be a lie if I'm posting it? He turned his ethnicity into an asset, capitalizing on the fact that many white Americans can't distinguish between an Hispanic and an Arab, especially if they're blinded by plenty of bling. And like many conmen before him, Gignac understood the nearly universal appeal of royalty. Even the rich and powerful, it seems, can't resist a crown. If you're trolling for big fish, the idea that standing behind you is the royal family of Saudi Arabia people with access to billions and billions of dollars. That resonates, says a Miami businessman who watched the prince in action. It gives you credibility. It all adds up. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.